Ukraine endures another weekend of deadly Russian bombings, one at a mail depot that killed a number of postal workers.
Workers were working on the packages, particularly what was reported by Nova Pochta, that those packages mostly were medical aid and humanitarian aid for civilians from the pre-frontline areas.
And silencing the truth tellers. Russia extends its detention of an American journalist.
A lot of media outlets started revising their policies and asking themselves a question whether they should pull out their correspondence from Russia.
And later in the program, how DNA is helping the arduous work of bringing answers to the families of tens of thousands of Ukrainians missing since the start of Russia's invasion. Today is Monday, October 23rd. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Lori London in Washington. Russian attacks on Ukraine continued to ramp up over the weekend, including a deadly missile strike on a mail depot in the eastern city of Kharkiv. I spoke with Anna Chernikova for an update as Ukrainian officials reported a record number of bomb attacks in the Kherson region.
Very unfortunate Saturday for Ukraine and particularly for the Kharkiv region. Russian launched a missile attack and on one of the Novopochta terminals. Novopochta is one of the main Ukrainian post service and it's considered one of the best. And in Kharkiv region, this particular terminal was one of the biggest in the region and was basically a central one for humanitarian aid transfer within the country and particularly to the front line areas. The shelling was carried out by two S-300 missiles and was carried out from the territory of Russia from Belgorod region, which is bordering Kharkiv region. This was confirmed by the Ukrainian authorities. We have confirmation about six people killed and 16 wounded. Two of those wounded are in extremely serious condition. Six are in serious condition. All victims are the workers of this terminal, so they are civilians, and Novopochta has already posted a couple of videos from just seconds before the attack. From these videos, we can see that basically the work was ongoing and all the workers were working on the packages, particularly what was reported by Novopochta, that those packages mostly were medical aid and humanitarian aid for civilians from the pre-frontline areas. I just ordered certain package from one of the local companies based in Kharkiv. And I was waiting for this package to arrive on Sunday. And just in the application of the post service, I just saw that the package was stuck in Kharkiv. And then the information about these attacks happened. So at this point, I, as many of other people, have no idea what's happening with their packages. But for Ukrainians, as a lot have already commented on this tragedy on the social media, a lot do not care really about the package, but about the lives of those who remain wounded in serious condition, especially.
Anna Chernikova reporting for VOA from Kyiv. We thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says Turkey plans to join a conversation on peace process this week aimed at bringing an end to Russia's invasion of Ukraine. It follows a week in which Russia's top diplomat traveled to North Korea and visited Iran's capital of Tehran on Monday. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more on that and further details on Russia's attacks over the weekend.
The operator of the facility said an air raid siren sounded moments before the attack, leaving those inside with nowhere to run and no time to seek shelter. By daybreak, drone video captured the damage as released by the national police. The attack followed a recorded message from Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in which he said he had spoken with his Turkish counterpart, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, saying the two leaders discussed an upcoming peace summit next week in Malta to bring an end to the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But days ago, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov visited an ally in the war, the Supreme Leader of North Korea, Kim Jong-un. Kim supports Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and the U.S. has accused him of supplying Russia with weapons. U.S. President Joe Biden welcomed European leaders to the White House on Friday, where he and his Western counterparts pledged support for Israel in its war with Hamas and assured Ukraine the bloc's support in its war would not waver. Meanwhile, Ukraine's armed forces continue their push to recapture land. Here, Ukrainian Marines move along the left bank of the Dnipro River to help pave the way for reinforcements to push across the Kherson region. For civilians in Ukraine who've already endured a winter of war, preparations are underway to keep warm and cook food should fighting again disrupt energy supplies as it did last year while the temperature dropped. All this comes in a week in which Ukrainian officials say they recovered some 14 artifacts allegedly stolen by a Russian man stopped at a U.S. airport for illegally importing them. Ukrainian officials say the destruction and pillaging of historical sites since Russia's invasion began amount to hundreds of millions of dollars of losses. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
A Russian court on Monday ordered a Russian-American journalist detained last week to remain in custody until early December. Alsu Kermasheva, an editor for the U.S. government-funded Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty, is the second U.S. journalist detained in Russia this year. Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich was arrested on espionage charges in March and remains in custody. Joining me to discuss the escalating risk for American journalists in Russia is Gulnoza Saeed, Europe and Central Asia Program Coordinator with the Committee to Protect Journalists. First off, just your reaction to this latest American journalist arrest.
CPJ condemned the detention and called on the Russian authorities to release Alsu Kermasheva immediately and drop all the charges against her. And we do the same today as we learned about the extension of her detention. Kermasheva's arrest is the most egregious instance to date of the abusive use of Russia's foreign agent legislation against journalists.
Why is this in particular so egregious?
Because this is detention, arrest of an American-Russian journalist, and she is facing up to 5 years in prison. The Russian foreign agent law has been used against journalists for a long time as a tool to silence independent reporting, and it has become one of the main tools of censorship Russian authorities have been using, especially since Russia started its full-scale invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. And we have seen many instances when this legislation has been used against journalists. But the fact that Kermasheva is an American journalist is similar to the case of Evan Gershkovich, another American journalist who has been in Russian detention since March on even more serious charges, espionage charges, as you know.
Would you say they're using these journalists as political pawns or trying to silence them? Because it sounds like Alsu was only there not working, but visiting family.
Exactly. First of all, the Russian authorities have been trying to silence any reporting, particularly by RFRL. And RFRL was one of the very first media outlets, along with its sister organization, Voice of America, to be labeled as media foreign agents in Russia by the Russian Ministry of Justice years ago. And different projects of RFRL and VOA, including Ideal Reali, for which Alsu Kermasheva has been an editor, were also included in the Russian Ministry of Justice's registry of foreign agents. Media outlets labeled as foreign agents. So this is definitely censorship. On the other hand, Russia has been trying to use Evan Gershkovich and now Alsu Kermasheva as hostages in order to increase its leverage, its bargaining in its negotiations with the United States. So answering your question, it is both.
The Biden administration has really urged all Americans to leave Russia, to not go to Russia due to their safety in this sort of situation. Would you say that, you know, this is just one more way of silencing whatever is going to be reported because it's going to deter more journalists from taking a risk of going into Russia?
Well, I think it's pretty safe to say that if you're a journalist with an American media outlet or with a media outlet from any country where governments have been supportive of Ukraine, a media outlet that has been reporting on Russia's war against against Ukraine independently from the Kremlin set narrative, then you are at risk of being detained and charged with very serious charges in Russia. And as we see with Alsu Kurmasheva, it's not safe even to visit Russia on a family visit. So after the detention of Evan Gershkovich in March, a lot of media outlets started revising their policies and asking themselves a question whether they should pull out their correspondents from Russia. Some have done so. Some foreign correspondents in Russia decided to leave Russia on their own will. But I wanted to reiterate that the work of independent journalists, both Russian and foreign, is extremely important because Russia has been becoming that terra incognita for the rest of the world, just like during the Cold War, when there have been very few reports coming from inside Russia. Journalists are the window, people who provide us with a window into Russia, where we can see how ordinary people live, what they are worried about, what they think about, how they think about the war and other issues. That's why the detention of Alsu Kurmasheva is so important for the future of independent reporting in Russia. And I again wanted to reiterate that Russian authorities should immediately release Alsu Kurmasheva, Evan Gershkovich, and all other detained journalists, both foreign and local. And the U.S. authorities should use everything in their power to ensure the release of Alsu and Evan.
Golnoza Saeed, Europe and Central Asia Program Coordinator with the Committee to Protect Journalists. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Lori London. A price cap on Russian oil was focused on starving Russia's President Vladimir Putin of cash, but it's largely been untested. Until now, we hear more from Associated Press correspondent Karen Chamis.
The Russian oil price cap was set at $60. The price of oil has traded above the price cap since July, pumping millions of dollars into the Kremlin's war chest. The current Israel-Hamas war has pushed up the price of oil further, and there's evidence that some traders and shippers are evading the cap. However, the first signs of enforcement are appearing 10 months after the price limit was imposed in December. The aim, to keep the Kremlin from pocketing extra profits to fund its war in Ukraine. I'm Karen Chamas.
Along with the thousands killed since the start of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, tens of thousands more are still missing, leaving families in further despair, not knowing the fate of their loved ones. The Ukrainian government enlisted the help of the International Commission on Missing Persons in The Hague to assist in finding and identifying those missing persons. I spoke with Catherine Bomberger, Director General of the organization, about their use of DNA and the immense challenges the work entails.
It is regrettable that people don't think about this because this has a direct impact on hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians. The numbers are high. We don't know exactly what they are, but they are certainly in the tens of thousands. The reason we don't have an exact number is because the government itself doesn't have an exact number. There are also cases of fallen and disappeared soldiers. And of course, there's a need to keep that information confidential by the government. So that would be included in the overall number. There are, of course, the cases of children that have been illegally abducted and deported, of which, you know, we don't know exactly what the number is. There are people that have been executed. Clearly, we've seen cases of that. And in many cases, not only executed, but their bodies hidden in mass graves. There have been towns wiped out. What we do know is it's huge. We know the number is big, and we know that the number is growing every day. And we are in touch with families of the missing who are trying to find information regarding their missing loved ones every day. And this is complicated and difficult because on the one hand, the Ukrainian authorities are fighting a war. And on the other hand, they've invited organizations such as ICMP or the ICC and many others to help them with an active investigation into war crimes and other atrocities, which include cases of missing and disappeared persons while there's an ongoing war. So this is really a complicated process that involves the state itself working to conduct these investigations in thousands of cases to a level where evidence can be provided to an international court, such as the ICC, or courts operating under universal jurisdiction, or courts in Ukraine, and also meeting the needs of a growing number of families of the missing to know what happened to their missing loved ones.
I understand you're working at the invitation of the government of Ukraine.
Correct.
To assist.
Yes.
Some of the work that you're doing involves actually using DNA.
We were initially invited to the prosecutor's office in 2014, following the discovery of mass graves in Slavyansk. Since then, we've been trying to get financial support to be able to carry out a program in Ukraine. That support arrived after the invasion took place in 2022, February 24th. So we're a bit behind the game. I think there's a lot we could have done already, but here we are. In line with what we've done in many other countries and what we're seeing in Ukraine, and this is why what you said earlier rings so true, a lot of people don't think about missing persons and having large numbers of missing persons being a consequence of conflict. And in fact, they are. So in order to find such a high number of missing persons and provide evidence regarding atrocities linked to their disappearance, this requires conducting investigations, as I said earlier, to a level where that evidence can be provided to a court. But that means doing this in tens of thousands of cases almost at the same time. So in order to do this, you need to ensure, number one, that the institutions that carry out this work, be it the prosecutor's office or the police or the SBU, the security services, that they harmonize their work. And that's not happening at the moment. And that's not a criticism. That's just simply because this is how things would have happened before February 24th, 2022. But the world has changed now, and Ukraine is dealing with a hugely abnormal set of circumstances, which requires this type of harmonization or unity of purpose between the various institutions. So to answer your question, yes. And these things have to happen simultaneously. We would help harmonize these institutions to help them, facilitate that process. They know this has to happen so that they work together. This could entail also creating a specific institution in Ukraine that would be responsible for coordinating the work of the various institutions. That institution also has to house data. And data in today's world, when you're dealing with massive crimes like this that are spread across the country, and which also necessitates working with families of the missing who are both in Ukraine and outside of Ukraine, needs to be coordinated and centralized in a specific record. So that institution should hold that record. That's number two. And there needs to be legislation created to secure the rights of families of the missing. Then to address your question about DNA, it is extremely important to use advanced technologies to locate and identify missing persons. So that means using data mining to have data regarding where the possible locations could be, aerial imagery to try to get closer to ascertain where these sites might be, properly documenting sites using advanced techniques in forensic archaeology and anthropology, documenting those sites, using DNA to lead the identification, to be the lead identifier, let's say, in identifying missing persons so that you only have a scientific means applied to these identifications, thereby providing irrefutable evidence of a person's identity that with proper chain of evidence can be linked back to the crime scene. So this is going to be very important when you have thousands and thousands, and bear in mind, we did this in the Western Balkans, when you have thousands and thousands of people missing due to criminal activity, war crimes, and other atrocities. This has to be a meticulous process led by science so that when the body is identified, and this can sometimes be challenging, the forensic pathologist or medical examiner can then, once we have the identity, look at cause and manner of death and link all of this information back to the crime scene and to other information that witnesses may have, including Ukrainian civil society, others that are human rights activists that are collecting information on human rights abuses and other atrocities. All of that data can be used to provide evidence of what happened to that missing person. This is also important, I should add, Lori, for families of the missing who are primarily women and children to secure justice, including custody of children, including inheritance rights and a whole host of other rights that go with this.
Have you had any success so far?
Right now, we have been working with Ukrainian authorities, the prosecutor's office, the police, and the security services on a case-by-case basis to identify persons who have gone missing. So yes, we've had, if you want to call it that, successes in being able to achieve an identification. However, if we work at this pace together with the Ukrainian authorities, priorities, this will take many, many years. So what we want to see is a different approach whereby data is collected from all families who claim to have missing person. That would mean their DNA. But to give you an analogous situation, in the former Yugoslavia, ICMP collected, with the permission of families, data from 100,000 families of the missing, both in the region and outside of the region. And that quantity of data will need to be collected at a minimum to help Ukraine. So that, to me, once we embark on that outreach process inside Ukraine and outside of Ukraine, that will tackle one of the issues, which means working very closely with survivor groups, with families of the missing, so that they understand the process. Because understanding DNA, I mean, I'm not a scientist, you're not a scientist. So getting them to see the labs, you know, explaining how this works, explaining that it will take time to do this, but that providing data puts them in a better situation than if they don't. Then you have the investigations into missing persons cases. And if we're just looking at it from a data matching point of view, you will have collected, on the one hand, sufficient data from families of the missing, while the pace of identifying missing persons or reuniting families will depend on the investigations, not the ability to obtain data from families of the missing. Whereas if you go case by case, this will take forever.
And I'm seeing the number 90,000 families. Mm-hmm. Is that your goal, to collect data from up to 90,000 families?
It's a working assumption of a number, that's all. If we were calculating that at the moment, and again, that's not a statement on how many people are actually missing, but if we calculate that the numbers are approximately 30,000 right now, to use advanced DNA methods to identify missing persons, which means kinship matching, by the way, Lori, that means that families that are alive, the immediate hereditary family, you know, nuclear family, have to provide genetic reference samples to match that to the person that is missing, whether that person is a child that has been deported or a person found in a mass grave site. So the number 90,000 means that we need to collect a minimum of 2 to 3 reference samples per missing person. So if the working assumption is 30,000, then that means we need to collect data from about 90,000 families of the missing.
We talked about there have been numerous occasions where mass graves have been discovered. Are you getting into that part of it where you're actually going to these places? And that's an extraordinary task on a personal level. How difficult is that for the people who are tasked with actually having to do that?
Well, as an organization, we probably have been to close to 5,000, if not more, clandestine grave sites as an organization over the last, let's say, 27 years since ICMP began working in the former Yugoslavia. So that work is normally carried out on a local level by national police, you know, and others, prosecutors that are tasked with doing this work. What Ukraine doesn't have, and most countries don't have, are PhD level forensic anthropologists, archaeologists, whose work is also necessary to carrying out this type of task, so that mass grave sites can be properly documented, properly excavated. I mean, this is a whole new world, which really started in earnest with Argentina, Guatemala, the former Yugoslavia, where this expertise is growing. So they would be the ones assisting and have been assisting already Ukrainian institutions in being able to carry out this work. Then there is the mortuary, of course, cause and manner of death, making sure that DNA is properly taken. It's a long and very meticulous process that involves quite a number of experts that ICMP has, from forensic archaeologists to anthropologists to genetic scientists.
You're in The Hague, close to the International Criminal Court. Are you specifically going to be working with them?
We are an intergovernmental organization based on a treaty. So our primary cooperation will be with the government of Ukraine, and our mandate is to ensure the cooperation of governments and others. This means that we want to help Ukraine locate and identify missing persons in an impartial manner based on the rule of law. So that means every single missing person case, whether they're Ukrainian or non-Ukrainian. With regard to the ICC, we maintain cooperation agreements with all of the courts here in The Hague, including the ICC. We signed a cooperation agreement with the Office of the Prosecutor in 2016. The way I see it, that cooperation with the ICC could be similar to the cooperation we had with the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, where we provided evidence in over 35 criminal cases, including, most famously, the Karadzic and Mladic cases.
Catherine Bomberger, Director General of the International Commission on Missing Persons in The Hague. And that'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com. And on social media, just follow VOA News. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening. Until next time, I'm VOA's Lori London.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.